Well, we talked about porn, taxes, being unfaithful in relationships, and also about being nice.
Excellent. Awesome.
I'm a hobo CEO, a hobo CEO. My company is wherever I go. I'm a hobo CEO. I'm a hobo CEO.
Business, lifestyle, and the philosophical implications of business whilst wearing shabby trousers or no trousers at all. Hello, ladies, gentlemen, and hobos. This is the Hobo CEO Podcast. I'm Chris Kirkland, coming to you from Tokyo, and I'm joined by...
Nico, and I'm currently in Berlin.
How's the weather?
Cold, and it's getting colder. It's right about time for me to leave, which I'm going to be doing in just a little more than 2 weeks. I'm going to be off to Thailand, Chris.
Nice.
Closer to you, we're going to be in a switch from an 8-hour time difference to a 2-hour time difference.
Nice.
Looking forward to that.
We'll almost be able to hear each other shouting out the window.
Almost. So before we jump right into our conversation, what do we have?
We have a request for our listeners. If you're new, jump onto Twitter, Hobo CEO, or Facebook, Hobo CEO, and follow us so you can keep up to date.
If you're using one of those fancy podcast apps, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And if you fancy, leave us a review, please.
That's very compelling. We should give away some stickers or something. But anyway, hopefully our words are enough to compel you to stop what you're doing and fiddle around with that ridiculous iTunes interface to give us a 5-star review.
Yeah,
anyway,
nice.
enough self-promotion.
Okay.
We shall start with a hobo suitcase interview, shan't we, Nico?
Yeah, let's look into the suitcase of one of our fellow hobo entrepreneurs.
So, coming to me today is fellow hobo Darren Joe. Hello, Darren.
Hello, hello.
And if I understand correctly, you're currently outside a cafe in Ho Chi Minh City.
That's right. I'm watching tons of motorbikes just going back and forth here, but it's good that at least you can hear me.
Excellent. Marvelous. So let's get down to business. So, Darren, sir, what in a sentence is funding your hobo existence?
So I basically get MBA candidates into top-ranked and interesting MBA programs around the world. That's what I do.
Nice. And what's the website that you do?
Oh, yeah. It's touchmba.com. So
marvelous. So, yeah, we'll be pimping your URL in the show notes, of course.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's what I like to hear.
Splendid. And, of course, I just answered the second question
yeah.
by explaining to everybody where you are. So currently you're in Ho Chi Minh. How long have you been there?
Well, so I've been here... for 2 years now. It's been my home base, even though I've traveled to other places. In fact, I believe earlier this year, I beat you in a handstand contest at your apartment in Ho Chi Minh.
Indeed. There will be a
rematch. Just have to remind your audience about that.
There will be a rematch and you will be obliterated.
Bring it on, man.
Did you beat Lawler? Jesse Lawler?
I've yet to compete against him. He's trying to avoid me.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a serious match when I'm back in town. Excellent. So let's move on to your luggage.
Yep.
What is the average weight of your luggage?
So, yeah, if there was a 100-meter hobo dash, I would definitely lose or get robbed because I'm the hobo that would be dragging around the big suitcase. So I usually have my carry-on, which is about 25 pounds, and like a big, you know... piece of luggage to check in, which is probably about 80-90 pounds. So
wow.
Yeah, so you know, I think I really love books, and I used to carry them with me from city to city, so I have this really bad habit of buying books even though I know I'm gonna have to lug them around, so that I'm usually dragging a few books in my suitcase, but I'm trying to switch to Kindle and ebooks, but it's just not the same.
Yeah, I know the thing. I like having physical books. Of course, I've got a Kindle, but I'm guilty of dragging a few books with me on occasion.
Yeah,
a heavy luggage man.
Yeah. I tend to, when I move to a new city, I tend to really see it as like my home. I tend to live in different cities for at least 6 months, and so it helps me a little bit to have a few more things. But I think as I get older and I travel more, that suitcase is getting lighter and lighter. But you have to realize I came from a sort of corporate background. I'm used to, I lived in Singapore for 6 years, so still have some bad unhobo-like habits to work on.
You've got four suits. Four Gucci
exactly.
Suits.
Exactly. Well, yeah. My thing is shoes for some reason. I have a lot of shoes. So basketball shoes, tennis shoes, dress shoes. I'm quite active, so I find it hard to get rid of those.
Well, it's interesting to hear a hobo with heavier luggage for change. Yeah. So the next question you've already answered, cabin luggage only. That's a big emphatic no.
Yeah.
So let's jump straight ahead to the third question. What is most likely to get you questioned by airport security?
I haven't had a problem so far, but probably my Blue Yeti microphone, which I use to record my podcast. It's a very awkward piece of luggage to be carrying around, or my tooth whitening gel that's in syringes. My teeth aren't that white.
In syringes, interesting.
Yeah.
I won't ask any more questions, but
good
answer. You're carrying syringes. Splendid. So next question, the most expensive and the least expensive thing that's worth carrying.
So by far my most expensive item is my MacBook, 15-inch laptop, and it's my life. So that's definitely the most expensive and valuable thing I carry around. Least expensive that is worth carrying is, I'd say for us U.S. citizens, is the Charles Schwab debit card, because I don't know if your other guests have mentioned this, but basically you can withdraw money from ATMs and get refunded, get completely refunded. So it's a fantastic card to have if you're a U.S. citizen.
Nice. Refunded on the visa fees or the...
Yeah, so, fees. I go to a random ATM here in Ho Chi Minh, and they charge me $3 because I'm using that ATM. Schwab will actually refund me all that money. So it's great because I don't have to worry about exchanging money really anymore. I can go to Bangkok, Ho Chi Minh, Singapore, wherever. That's a huge and not very expensive thing that I carry around.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a good tip. Splendid. So final question, anything else we might like to know about your luggage?
Not really. I'm just pretty boring when it comes to my luggage. I guess just got a simple black backpack and black suitcase. And like I said, I carry around too many books and too many shoes. So,
tell us one of the titles of the books that you're carrying around.
Oh, wow. So one of the books is The Art of Living, which is basically a book about meditation, and I believe it's the Visapana meditation that I've been getting really into lately. So that's kind of my go-to book of the moment.
Vipassana.
I don't know how to say it.
That's how I pronounce it, but I could be wrong as well.
I'm a novice, so forgive me.
What a coincidence, because we just had Almog on our last show, and he was talking all about Vipassana.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Splendid.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Darren, it's been a pleasure having you show us the contents of your hobo suitcase. And we'll get you on the show again for a more in-depth interview at some point.
Awesome. And have you guys actually shared what's in your luggage?
We haven't yet.
Oh, see, that's unfair.
Well, I have. I posted it on the site, pictures and everything of my bright pink bag and the three pairs of underwear. So I have actually revealed my luggage.
It's getting a lot of
hits. I'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, getting a lot of hits. your pink underwear.
my pink bag. I think I might conceal the pink underwear. Although I do have pink underwear, I won't deny.
All right.
Cool. Nice one. Thanks for joining us, Darren.
All right, awesome. Guys. Yeah.
So marvelous. Nice hobo interview this week. Hobo suitcase interview. So we recorded a conversation about, what was it about, Nico?
Well, we talked about porn, taxes, being unfaithful in relationships, and also about being nice.
Excellent. So let's trundle over to our conversation. Morality biscuits. Do you have them with your tea? Do you have them with your coffee? Or do you just have them straight?
As an Englishman, I guess you'd prefer to have them with your tea. I'm more of a coffee person, as you know.
Exactly. So morals are a very subjective thing. There's no objective, correct way to eat your morality biscuit.
But they are subjective, not in the sense of individual subjectivity, but probably more on the level of, it's a group thing, right? Morality is about society or sub-parts of society, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose you can abstract it to different levels. At the greatest level, it's just all subjective. At kind of maybe a kind of deeper level, it's like the decision, the kind of the moral compass is steered by the opinion of the whole society. And then on a more sort of micro level, it's like, you know, it's your own opinion. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the philosophical conclusion on the subject is morals are generally subjective. Right and wrong is a matter of opinion. So why are we talking about this? How does this become relevant to the hobo entrepreneur?
Because I think that every self-reflective person, like, this is a recurring subject. You will never have your principles that straight that you never have to, that you won't have to, you know, consider how whatever your principles or your morale is, how it applies to a new situation. Since you brought the topic up, I'm always wondering, as maybe some of our listeners also do, what the difference is between the difference or the relationship between morality and ethics. And just to clarify that, the philosophy of morality is ethics. So on the Hobo podcast, we're probably talking about ethics.
So we're just basically talking about one's opinion of right and wrong. So it kind of matters to us because we're doing business, and inevitably during our business, there'll be choices that we make which touch on our integrity, our feelings of what's right or wrong, whether we are able to do something or not and still feel comfortable with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Running your own business, you get a lot more sort of freedom. Coming with that comes responsibility. Since, if you look at the philosophical conclusion, it's generally a matter of opinion, it casts this sort of, this strange sort of mysterious air of doubt over what is right and wrong. Wearing the philosophical hat, as you know, it's subjective, it's just a matter of opinion, there's no objective right or wrong. So you think, well, do I kind of make money from sex, drugs, rock and roll, or do I do a service that's helping people and making the world a better place? So this is the kind of thought line that I'm referring to. I think we can kind of step away from the world of opinions and start looking at basic selfish drives. If we look at the model of us being selfish gene machines, we're kind of basically the result of millions of years of evolution, and we're the result of these units of evolution called genes, which selfishly want to reproduce. There's actually a benefit to being quote unquote good for survival purposes.
Mm-hmm.
If all the genes are just 100% selfish and kind of try and destroy everything but themselves, that isn't an optimal survival strategy. There is actually a level of cooperation and what would appear to be kindness or even altruism is seemingly more optimal for survival. Or so it would seem, because we are the current contemporary product of all the millions of years of evolution.
You mean like there's something like a forced goodness in built into evolution?
It's kind of like if you were to be selfish, it would be most efficient to be good to a certain extent. That's the most selfish strategy. If you're 100% selfish, you might die faster than if you're only 20% selfish and 80% giving.
Okay.
So just to reiterate, what I'm saying is that rather than getting lost in the idea of one's opinion on right or wrong, I'm suggesting that we're just actually, it's our genes which really decide what our thoughts and our opinions are, and kind of something we're out of control of.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you think it's, logically, you think it's right or wrong to sell your grandma's false teeth or something.
Yeah.
I forget the proverb. Say you rationally think, well, it's okay to rip off my own grandma. Mm-hmm. You still kind of feel opposed to doing that at some level.
Okay.
And so I think there's a kind of blend of our genes, our feelings, and our thoughts involved here.
So some maybe more concrete examples from our experience are, for example, people that make money. Like, I think one of the first encounters that I had with this was I met a couple of business people early in my entrepreneurial career, and they, for example, said that there seems to be a rule, no porn and no gambling.
Yeah.
So, okay. No, I think it was porn, gambling, and tobacco. I think that's a group of or areas of businesses that, you know, people can either do and then there's one path, or they say, we don't do that. Okay, so one possible distinction. Another would be, let's talk about some examples, like what could you sell that is totally unquestionable in terms of morality, and what could you sell or make money from that's more questionable?
Well, I would preface my answer to this with there's no absolutes here.
Yeah, but let's say from a current
okay,
standpoint.
Well, let's just not think, let's forgetting kind of the absolutes. You could say things like doing something that was helping distribute mosquito nets around the third world and developing countries.
Yes.
Something that's a highly efficient charity along those lines.
Yes.
That would be on the kind of top of the sort of, let's say, the white end of the spectrum, the good end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something like selling some dodgy info product, which is really just nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Just nonsense, yeah. Maybe it is just nonsense. Let me kick in here. I remember meeting a guy in one of the early DC meetings in Berlin, and everybody introduced themselves, and he said that he's in the niche of selling, as an affiliate, selling these Get Your Ex Back information products. And actually I asked him about how he feels about that, like how openly he shares what he's doing with other people, let's say outside of an, you know, like online entrepreneur business meeting. And he said, well, you know, I mean, he was definitely a little like smiling or smirking, whatever, you know, like, but he understood that it is a kind of a interesting point. And he said, well, you know, it's really interesting because he studied the whole, like the problem and the market and what people need and why they buy these kinds of products, as you wouldn't need to do as a good marketer. And he said, it's really interesting because even though the product could be seen as pretty, as you said, like nonsense or maybe even shitty, it also helps a lot of people get over what they're currently in. And he said, like, look, if you look at these products, none of them, this is really interesting, are actually going to, as a primary goal, basically, help you get your ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend back. But they this is where they basically pick you up. There's the point of sales, basically, and then they will help you understand that you're in a new situation now and how you can basically pick up yourselves after the heartbreak and get back into, you know, regular social life and not get depressed and so on. So there was something good hidden, something quote unquote good hidden in the whole process. Yeah, just as a little anecdote. So yeah, it's at the same time, it's kind of a weird kind of information product.
It's not doing what it says on the tin. It's basically not going to get your ex back.
Yes. And which is an interesting case in point, because I remember my own struggles with learning about marketing and how marketing works. And, you know, there's always this line where marketing blends into manipulation. Even that is a word that has bad associations, even when it actually isn't necessarily something that's bad. I mean, every teacher wants to manipulate their pupils and so on. But I remember struggling with that, and Eben Pagan had an interesting reframe on the subject. He said that because we function as we do as humans, as a marketer, as a good marketer, you'd have to basically do this, like in the get your ex back program. You have to get people at a point and promise them something that they think they want, and then help them understand that it's not really what they want and that you're not going to help them actually get that. And he says, the metaphor is, he says you have to put a pill into a piece of meat and feed it to the dog, because the dog is not interested in taking the pill itself, but he will eat the meat, and while chewing the, you know, eating the meat, he will then also get the pill. And that was the metaphor that he used.
There's a moral question about doing that. The conclusion here is you take on a responsibility if you do something like that. If if you're the owner of the dog, you know you're responsible for the dog and you want it to be well, so you give it the medication that you believe it needs. And if it dies, then okay, you've got no one else to blame but yourself. Then the same thing is if you run some sort of information product or some sort of course, and you you know, you think you're doing the right thing, but you end up with a load of people who really hate you and are really angry and think it was a load of rubbish or something, then you suffer the consequences for that action that you take.
So you're talking about karma now, in a way.
Simple responsibility. It's like if you manipulate people, then there are consequences for that manipulation. There's
yes.
a potential that you could be manipulating them in a dangerous or, you know, suboptimal way,
yes.
which would come back to affect you.
Don't get me wrong. I don't want to, like the karma reference is not only meant to be funny. I just recently came across, there's a concept that basically sounds a little bit like karma in scientific terms. It's like, I was looking up the functions of gossip and how gossip works, because I wanted to write a little piece on it. And gossip enables something like reciprocal. Yeah, and the noun to that would be?
Oh, I don't know. You're asking the wrong guy.
Yeah, but everybody knows now what the word is. We don't have to say it. And, you know, that can be, for example, if you tell other people about somebody who helped you, that would be the gossip thing, like a real life testimonial, that could help this other person that helped you to get help from somebody else because they heard that they are themselves a helpful person. Was that clear?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not sure how the scientific term for that mechanic is, but it sounds to me a little bit like what I was funny referencing with the karma thing. So I'm just saying, like, you know, it could help, and it also blends in the evolutionary thing that you mentioned earlier, like just being selfish wouldn't be the most beneficial approach to survival and reproduction.
There are consequences.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic premise. If you're selfish, or if you manipulate people, whether you do it in a good way or a bad way, there will be consequences, which mm-hmm. could be good or could be bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of the perspective from which I'm coming at the morality argument. I don't so much look as to think whether things are good or bad, because that's essentially a matter of opinion. What I do look at is, well, there are consequences. It's perhaps a little complex, because you might be doing a business which is, let's say, subjectively bad. You're doing it with a suitable level of anonymity, so like your friends and your family don't really understand your business, and you make a lot of money, and you're really kind of generous and nice, and you kind of set things up so you're not really ripping people off much money. Say you're kind of selling some kind of crappy product for $30. No one's really going to hate you for that. It's like they might be a little bit disgruntled, but it's not like you're conning people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if you kind of set something like that up, then you're in a position where you've kind of really carefully negotiated mm-hmm. the shades mm-hmm. of white and the shades of grey, and you've managed to sort of ride a fairly grey path but still end up without too many negative consequences.
I see.
That's kind of a model that's kind of settled in my head for how it's possible to do something that's subjectively not exactly good, but not really on the bad side of the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give a simpler example, though. If you just keep doing good things, then like you're saying, people will talk about you and say, oh, he's a really nice guy, he's really helpful. And that kind of increases your chances of a sort of really positive upside at some point in the future. If you do stuff like you keep letting people down and people notice that you're kind of like dishonest in your marketing and stuff, that's also going to propagate, and that increases a sort of potential downside in your future. I'd like to kind of just reiterate those three sort of strategies. There's the one where you're kind of really nice and that maybe exposes you to some sort of nice upside.
Mm-hmm.
There's the one where you're sort of bad and that exposes you to a different sort of downside. And then there's maybe this sort of gray area in between where you manage to sort of balance doing something that's maybe not optimal, but it's not really that seen. What I'm pointing at with that middle example is how this could be a very complex situation. And
yes.
It's not like you can just categorically say, well, it's optimal to be good.
Yes. So I hear between the lines that there's something like temptations that you come across on your, for example, entrepreneurial path. Can you remember ones that you had and how you dealt with them?
Yes. One of the earlier business opportunities which came up for me was making tools for people doing gambling, making betting calculators, which mm-hmm. allowed people to make more to have better understandings of the risks they were taking when they were placing bets.
Yes.
It was kind of, I don't know if the correct term is intelligent gambling. Anyway, a friend of a friend and one of his friends brought this idea to me, and they wanted me to kind of do the technical side. And I actually got quite deep into it. I made a lot of these tools and stuff. Like when it came close to completion, I'd quite enjoyed the process of making these tools because it was quite sort of mathematically challenging and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I just realized I was just so not interested in the world of gambling, and I just didn't feel that kind of happy about it. And it's perhaps one of the kind of worst business decisions I've made, because it was and still is, I assume, a very lucrative market. But I just didn't feel behind it. You know, mm-hmm. we've previously talked about alignment. I had no alignment with this. So I basically, after, you know, all these weeks of work, I just kind of ditched everything, you know, moved on and did something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one clear example from me. How about you, Nico?
Well, one of the problems I seem to be going around in circles and coming back to that, I mean, again and again, is, for example, if you look into, if you learn about marketing and selling, I mean, you know, types of businesses. If you, for example, have read the 4-Hour Work Week and then you think, well, this is great stuff, I'm going to build an information product, and you look into and you get a little more accustomed with what people are doing in the information product niche, people will also recommend that there are three main areas where you should start your, where you should do an information product. And I have to say that all three of them are probably like possible temptations, but also not really attractive to me. That's why I always struggle to really execute in one of those areas. The areas, usually the popular areas mentioned, are you have to do something in the area of money, which means you have to create a product in the how to become rich niche. You can do something in terms of relationships. That's like, I don't know, anything from pick up to get your ex back. And the third thing is fitness, but then fitness sounds better than most of those products, because the products are actually like the really popular products are like the truth about apps. No, I mean, seriously, these are the products that are really, really successful, are the ones that always tackle like the very embarrassing things that people really suffer from, where there's a high pain point, things that are super embarrassing to them. The reason why there's a lot of money to be made there is not only because not a lot of people want to touch this in terms of like selling that kind of products, but also because people are, I wouldn't necessarily say they are willing to spend money, but they are high on emotions, you know, and usually they are high on very agitating emotions, not necessarily enthusiasm you're talking about. I mean, if you, I don't know, like dealing with people in these kinds of states, or even like doing marketing to push them into those kind of states, feeling more ugly about their overweight, being overweight and feeling, and you know, blah, blah, and pushing all those trigger points and then selling them the solution. It's hard. And we also know, I mean, we also know people that seem to have made a lot of money selling e-cigarettes, for example. It's not the tobacco industry, but it's, yeah, I mean, would I get a hard-on about it? I'm not sure. Not now. Not really.
I wonder, you know, if...
Although at some level, sorry, at some level, obviously I envy people that make a lot of money with a business like that, but it's not really. And to get really personal about the two of us, Chris, working with ArtWeb and building something for artists and creative people, a service which is low priced and high value in my opinion, we felt good about that. I mean, we were also realizing and talking about, hey, look, I mean, we are not doing something weird. We're just like helping people to get their art online, promote their work and so on. We build a tool for that. That's great. You know,
I'm not sure exactly how that points to with the artists, but let me just kind of make a slight transition back to entrepreneurs and freelancers. Because I think one of the common questions that comes up with people at the very beginning is how much should they charge? And I think everyone can, or most people can relate to that feeling of feeling a little bit like sort of uncomfortable about saying that's going to be $4,000, please. Or even that's going to be $200. There's this kind of like feeling that everyone who's doing business has to sort of get comfortable with, you know, in order to be able to state their price, understand what their value is, maybe even go over what they feel their value is. And it's a key aspect in how much money you're going to make. I think maybe tying this back into this sort of, maybe this idea of what our genes dictate, like we've both kind of, I guess, painted the picture that we're like nice guys, that we're kind of moral and we're kind of avoided all the dodgy stuff. It could well be that we're genetically predisposed to being more on the nice side of the spectrum than other people who just kind of more naturally, as a matter of course, well, I don't know, it's not that bad. You know, I'm not peddling kids or anything. I'm just selling some info product. I made $1 million, you know, I've given my grandma a nice home. You know, you might get people who kind of can really easily justify themselves things that we just kind of have avoided. It could be genetics. It could be backgrounds. You know, we've kind of, I'm guessing we've both had fairly sort of comfortable, nice middle class upbringings where, you know, we've had sort of nice, comfortable surroundings. Whereas you can imagine one thing I notice in other parts of the world, perhaps Asia in particular, people seem to be much more okay with making money. I hear about stories of like commerce in China, and it seems like everyone's ripping everyone off left, right, and center. And it seems a matter of course. It seems like, you know, as long as you protect your family, it doesn't matter. You know, you of course you're going to rip everybody off. So you can buy a house for your mom. You know, it's, of course.
That's morality on a cultural level then, which, you know, can be really different. I mean,
yeah. So this is, I mean, maybe it's a genetic thing, maybe it's a cultural thing. It would be interesting to see if there's any research on this.
But you said we painted ourselves as nice guys or whatever. Do you think we painted, or are we really, or is that a thing that can change?
I guess it's quite subjective. Maybe to some people, we're already not nice guys because we're like taking part of the capitalist economy. You're sat in Berlin.
True.
I'm sure there's plenty of people in your neighborhood which would sort of, you know, look down upon our capitalist exploits. But so again, I think it's quite a subjective matter, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we can see historically socialist ideals don't seem to play out because it seems at some level humans are basically greedy. And maybe greedy is a bit of a sort of misleading word because it's like we're out to survive, and greed is a sort of survival tactic. If you frame it that way, if you look at nature, animals, essentially, that's what they do just to survive. You know, because we've got these complex brains which allow us to communicate and formulate concepts, it allows us to sort of talk about things like greed, whereas animals just, you know, they're just doing it to survive.
I have to say that one thing that I'm not necessarily proud of, but that I'm happy with, is that I haven't done anything in my past, at least consciously, or anything that I know of, that I really regret on the level of I have done really something wrong. I have slipped, you know, in terms of morality, like really misguided someone or whatever the thing may be. And I oftentimes think about this also in the area, for example, of let's say romantic relationships, where all these possible scenarios could come up, where you say, like, let's say you have a situation where you could be unfaithful. That's the word I was looking for. You could be unfaithful and nobody would ever know about it. Would you do it? I mean, if all the external pressure would go away, could you live with yourself? Like, that's an interesting question. Like, how could you live with yourself if you know you did something? I'm glad that I have none of those struggles going on. I have none. No, I have not no bones,
skeletons in your closet.
Basement. Is that
in
my closet? Okay, in Germany you would have them in the basement. Depends on where you live, where you put your skeletons, obviously. Yeah, so I have no, you know, nightmares about that kind of stuff. I might have missed out on some other things, but that's so far.
So I guess that's another one of the downsides of doing something that's quote unquote bad, perceived as bad. So I think this introduces the idea of integrity, which I guess I would define as acting within your own sort of set of rules.
Mm-hmm. And according to what you have communicated, you think is right and wrong. Like, I mean, it's like following what you said.
So there could conceivably be a situation where one of these temptations you just feel isn't bad. It's for somebody else, it might seem bad, but for yourself, it doesn't. Like maybe the idea of charging someone $2,000 instead of $1,000. You know, for some people, that might just you might just feel like you're ripping off. But someone else might feel like, no, you know, I deserve more. I'm kind of high value. That could very well be acting within your own integrity for someone. But for somebody else, it would be kind of outside the scope of what they believe in. So this is the idea of integrity. Mm-hmm. It's for doing the same act for two different people might have different interpretations. For one person, it would be within their integrity. It would be integral to still do that. For somebody else, it would be kind of outside what they believe is correct. Yeah, so this idea of integrity. There's one final ingredient I want to add to the mix, and that's kind of necessity. We're in this very luxurious position where we can actually choose what we do. You know, if we were starving and living in the wild, we would be faced with much smaller set of choices. It would be basically kill that animal there, or potentially it's game over. And arguably we wouldn't even be able to make that choice. We'd be driven to act.
Yeah, that's true. Choice is power. Choice is empowering. Maybe that's the better the better way to put it.
But I wonder, because I've come across people, fellow entrepreneurs, who seem to have a different set of rules. Their integrity is quite different from mine. They're often much more wealthy than I am.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's. I think a lot of people can relate to that. I think some people might even, from a different perspective, say that all these people that do that make money online or have any sort of online business are already those people that are in the group where it's unfair that they're making that amount of money. Especially like if you're coming from a traditional business, brick and mortar kind of thing, where you might have no chance of quadrupling your revenue within 3 months. And we hear these kinds of stories all the time.
And you get things like loopholes. You get people that find little cracks in the system where you can put a bucket underneath it and money just starts pouring out. And sometimes they're harmless and sometimes they're kind of obnoxious, like domain squatting is perhaps a example entrepreneurs will all be familiar with. I'm sure half of us all own a few domains and half of us have all been frustrated by the fact that we can't register a domain because someone's speculating. So you get kind of opportunities like that. It's like it's not necessarily bad per se, but it's not something that's necessarily making the world a better place. I guess another more generic example would be like the idea of being a middleman. There's lots of industries where there's layer upon layer of middleman taking a kind of slice off the slice off the pie or off the slice of the cheese, let's say. And so like the person that wants to buy the cheese gets just a really small bit of cheese at the end.
Okay, so taxes, not the state in not the state in the US, the AXE taxes. I can say that as of yet, I have not done any dodgy taxes things. But if you like walking down the entrepreneurial path, by the way, are we walking down or walking up the entrepreneurial path? But you know, talking to entrepreneurs, you will find it's. I just like when you said loophole. I was thinking like, oh, taxes, man. I mean, of course, we have come across people that have all sorts of interesting ways to, let's say, save some of their taxes, spend less money on taxes. But there's also these really popular big corporation examples. Like there's been like articles about how, for example, Apple and Amazon, how they have their this nice stuff where they have, you know, like I'm not sure what the there's a term for it, but you have to have like part of your company is in Ireland, another part of your company is in Luxembourg, and like for example, Amazon and Apple, like the iTunes store is basically it's in Luxembourg and they'd only sell to private customers. Like you can't buy anything on the App Store as a corporation. Like basically they only sell private B2C basically. And there's a tax law in Luxembourg that says if you sell to somebody VAT, and that's what they basically do. And they save up all this money and obviously provide us with low prices on technology and Amazon on everything else. So what about taxes? I mean, how much will the entrepreneur collide with the making a contribution to the home country or to the area where you make business or, you know, especially with low?
Well, yeah. I think I'll take the ball. And then let me go a bit big picture first. I think really,
Please.
This is very much like an artifact of having the concept of a state or a country. It's it's one of the downsides of having such a large group of people is, you know, nobody really knows each other at that scale. You're all kind of fairly anonymous and there's this sort of supposed loyalty to the country that you're in, but there's kind of so many people in between that it's not like your family. You don't have like the genetic links to people. You don't have the sort of friendship familiarity that you've built with the people around you. It's at such a large abstract level that you're kind of supposedly meant to be part of this group, but you really kind of want to get as much out of the group as you can, putting as little in. Of course, you know, that's kind of how you genetically evolved to operate. So I think very much this is just simply a symptom, a side effect of what happens when you start kind of categorizing humans in these large groups. What's going to happen really is, bringing it in more modern terms, I think it's very much like the insurance. It's kind of like the people playing, it's like a game that you play to lose. Like the people who lose at insurance are the people who pay insurance but don't make a claim. They're basically funding everybody else who makes a claim, or who people who don't make claims dishonestly. There's nothing to be gained in the system for the people who honestly, or not necessarily honestly, pay taxes. People who kind of pay taxes without trying to pay as little tax as possible. You don't get anything extra from paying more tax than your neighbor who's figured out that if they buy this asset and then sell that other asset, then it works out that they pay 5% less tax. This goes to its logical extreme with larger institutions or with people who've got more money because they can afford to pay smart accountants who can kind of read all the rules and legislations and figure out how to legally move things around. And of course, this pisses everybody off because they can't afford those accountants and they're just ending up paying more tax because they don't understand. So I think I think it's just a sort of logical consequence of having a state, having a kind of country with that many people, and with it's just a kind of inefficiency. I give the green light to everybody and anybody to take it upon themselves to pay as little tax as they legally should, because it's really down to the state to figure out the most fair and sensible way of taxing its individuals. I guess at the end of the day, the individual doesn't really have much choice because we're all born in a certain territory, and that comes with it. So we get certain benefits from that, and we get certain obligations.
Yeah, and let me throw in that we are both from European countries or whatever, but some of our friends from the US, I think, what is it, like the US, and then there's one or two other countries in the whole world that have this other system. Like, I can hear the Americans already screaming about this, because I can opt out. If I go to the German tax department and I tell them that I'll be out of Germany for most of the year and so on, then there's the different laws that come in, and I shouldn't have to pay taxes in two countries at once and that kind of stuff, you know. But the Americans, they, like, whatever they do, once you if you file taxes in the States once, you have to for a lifetime, like, no matter where you go and where you make your money and how you make your money. That's it's brutal. That's why, I mean, the only chance to get out of that is to renounce US citizenship, which, you know, is a trend with some.
I remember Simon Black being really scathing about the idea of taxation. And it's essentially, he said, it's essentially just people with an army kind of stealing money from you. He kind of framed it in that kind of way, which...
Which
is a valid way of looking at it. That's essentially what it is.
It's the liberal view. I think Rob Mott explained to us, it's the liberal anarchist. So what's the?
But of course, I think you've got to take into a fact that without things like states, without things like this, there may be no peace. You know, you might be fending for survival every moment of your life, paying like 15% income tax or something, or 25% or whatever, is perhaps preferable to having to kind of kill people on a daily basis just to survive.
Yeah, it's true.
But maybe there's a third way, you know, maybe there's a Star Trek future out there where we're all kind of doing things for the greater good, and there's like no bad stuff happening anymore. We're kind of on a spaceship. Yeah, we're just trying to help out aliens in other parts of the universe.
Mission to be nice. Which brings me back to, you met Peter Shankman.
I did.
and in Tokyo and had dinner with him. And Peter's whole current, like what he talks about, seems to be about how it being nice pays off, right?
Which I think really ties in really closely to what you said earlier on about, like, you know, people kind of talking about somebody who'd been helpful. There's these kind of this upside and perhaps potentially very big upside to being nice, which was one of Peter's examples. He said something like he was at a hotel and the toothbrush was missing from his room, and they quickly kind of went and bought one over the road or something and gave it to him. And because of that really good customer service experience, he's been recommending that chain of hotels. And he's saying that kind of, you know, 50 cents purchase of a toothbrush has resulted in like $30,000 worth of business because of all the referrals he's made.
Yes. And he's not even mentioning the affiliate commission that he takes. No, just kidding. Obviously, he doesn't. Yeah, but that's interesting. And since I mentioned the gossip and the function of the functions of gossip, we came into the whole list, the cycle of reciprocity, but you know what I mean. With social media nowadays and the interwebs, this has become way more immediate. I mean, like through Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff, like if you do something good, the word can spread much faster than it has could have spread in, 20 years ago. So I think that's also what Peter refers to. So it pays off even sooner. Don't have to don't have to wait for future generations of your, it's good.
So the moral of the story is be nice, kids. Yes, play nice.
Be nice, hobos, and be nice to the hobos. Okay, so I think that wraps it up for our current view on morality and what kinds of businesses we could do and how unfaithful we could be and how much taxes we're gonna pay in the future. Coming up in next couple of weeks, we're aiming at publishing one episode of the podcast per week.
Keeping up our weekly schedule.
It should be around Friday. So we have a Facebook page now. There's a Facebook page just to stay connected. And Hobo Hangouts. We are going to put one up on the website and we're going to make little topics for the Hangouts and people are free to join in.
So stay tuned with us on Twitter and Facebook and we shall announce the next Hobo Hangout.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Splendid. Thanks for joining, chaps. See you next time.
See you next time.
Hiring, hovering, lunching, launching, morality, morons, pipe dreams, protons, hunting, leaping, jumping, kite surfing, landing pages, optimization, and superheroes. Another amazing podcast magic production.